the death toll climbs from an attack on a Ukrainian train station.
25 people were killed. This includes 2 children. And for the moment, we know about 31 people injured.
Plus, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says they're close to reaching an agreement to allow them to visit the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. And later in the program...
At the same time, as a diplomat, you have to hope for an end to violence, because the violence never really begets anything positive.
We speak with a former U.S. ambassador about how he sees the current situation in Europe and the challenges moving forward facing the EU, NATO, and the world. Today is Thursday, August 25th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. The death toll from a Russian attack on a train station on Ukraine's Independence Day has risen to 25. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv joins us with the grim details.
Yesterday, there were a certain amount of missile attacks and a lot of air raid alarms around the whole territory of Ukraine. And probably the worst one happened in the evening, closer to the end of the day. It happened in Chopline, in Dnipropetrovsk region. And as President Zelensky mentioned, Russian missile hit the railway station and the surrounding residential sector next to this station. What we know for the moment that 25 people were killed. This includes 2 children. And for the moment, we know about 31 people injured. We don't know exactly the level of the injuries. And of course, unfortunately, numbers could change. Still, we are waiting for the update later on during the evening. But for the moment, this is what we know. And this was the worst attack that happened yesterday.
And you mentioned that there were a significant number of attacks taking place throughout the country. According to some information, there were nearly 200 air raid siren alarms, more than any other day during the past 6 months.
Yes, yesterday was a certain record, all-time record for a full-scale invasion. So yesterday, it was officially 189 air raid alarms announced in Ukraine. Most of them were covering those areas which are constantly under attacks, the south part and Donbas. But in Kyiv alone, it was 7 times. And the 8th one was during the night. Previous record, so-called record, was on April 23. It was Easter Eve, and it was 109. So this time it's 80 more. So basically, as I already mentioned, the worst one was in Dnipropetrovsk region, but also there were 2 hits in Zaporizhia, and it was civil infrastructure mostly damaged. Also, very bad heat happened in Mirhorod, which is Poltava region. 4 hits, military infrastructure. Reportedly, X-22 missiles were used for this attack by Russian forces. Also, Dnipropetrovsk region suffered yesterday before the evening attack. They also suffered when missiles hit private sector building, and 2 children were rescued from under the rubble of this building. So for the moment, we only know about the damages. Also, during the day, missiles hit infrastructure in military infrastructure in Khmelnytsky region, which is in the west part of the country, and also air raid, air defense. Ukrainian air defense was very active yesterday, and a lot of missiles were destroyed.
I also understand that some missiles also hit the Vyshhorod district near Kyiv.
Yes, this happened during the night. So the night on August 25th, and these missiles hit Vyshhorod district of the Kyiv region. It's quite close to Kyiv city itself. For the moment, we know that there are no victims or wounded civilians reported. And we don't have any information about damages of the civilian infrastructure. However, we know that There are specialists and rescue team working on the site, and they are studying the site. And we are also waiting for additional details, because for the moment we don't know exactly what was the target and the amount of damages.
Anna Chernikova reports for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much for your reporting today.
Thank you, Steve.
In a Facebook post, Ukrainian energy operator Enerhoatom says that the Russian-occupied Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine was disconnected from the national power grid on Thursday because of damage caused by a nearby fire. Enerhoatom says the fires damaged the fourth and last connection line from the two working nuclear reactors to the grid. The news comes as the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, told France 24 television the IAEA may be able to visit the site shortly.
Now there is general recognition that we need to be there. We need to be there soon. Kyiv accepts it. Moscow accepts it. We need to go. And we are going to be there hopefully very, very soon.
Is very soon days or weeks?
Days.
Visit voanews.com/flashpoint for additional updates on the war throughout the day. Britain says that it's going to share technical expertise with Ukraine as part of a new package of support to help the country rebuild its infrastructure and transport network following Russia's invasion earlier this year. British Transport Secretary Grant Shapps says that British experts will offer technical knowledge in airport, runway, and port reconstruction, and also will help identify training opportunities for aviation staff. Now, as mentioned on Wednesday's program, U.S. President Joe Biden has announced a nearly $3 billion aid package for Ukraine. Now, this new aid comes on top of more than $10 billion in military assistance the United States has already sent to Ukraine in the past year and a half. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more details on what's in this latest tranche of assistance.
Puma drones, counter-artillery radars, and up to six additional National Advanced Surface-to-Air missile systems, like the ones used to protect the skies of Washington, all part of a new $3 billion military aid package to fulfill Ukraine's long-term defense needs. It's by far the largest military aid package for Ukraine to date, with money for training Ukraine's forces and maintaining their weapons. Pentagon Undersecretary of Defense Colin Call tells reporters the aid is a multi-year investment rolled out over the next 3 years.
Packages like this that signal we're not just providing assistance to Ukraine right now, but it's going to be a steady stream of assistance that will stretch out over many months and years, is precisely challenging Putin's miscalculation, we believe, that he can just grind it out and wait it out.
The United States continues to hope for a peaceful resolution to the conflict. And Call says the Pentagon designed the security aid to bolster Ukraine's defenses regardless of the war's duration.
If the war continues for years, this package is relevant. If there is a ceasefire or a peace settlement, this package is still relevant because Ukraine needs the ability to defend itself and deter future aggression.
The U.S. has now spent more than $13 billion to support Ukraine in the past year and a half.
This war is also our war. Ukraine is also fighting for us. This war is really the war also about the future of authoritarian system versus democracy.
And the administration says the latest aid package to Ukraine won't be its last. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Despite repeated calls from world leaders for Russia to leave Ukrainian territory and cease all hostilities, there appears to be no end in sight for the conflict. That's why I sat down with Ambassador Daniel Speckard, president of Chorus International, a non-governmental organization that works with communities to help them recover from natural and other disasters, to get a broader picture of where he sees things now and where they may be headed in the future. Spierkard was also the U.S. ambassador to Belarus during the Clinton administration and served as the U.S. ambassador to Greece under both Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. We started our conversation with Ambassador Spierkard sharing his high-level assessment where he sees things now, 6 months after Russia's latest invasion and more than 8 years after it took control of the Crimean Peninsula.
Well, this is obviously, for someone who's worked on European security for decades, a really disturbing and disappointing turn of events in the world where we thought there would be a Europe free and whole and at peace. And most of us were hoping not to see anything since the Balkan Wars occurring again in that region. So to see this kind of level of fighting happening in the heart of Europe is really discouraging, dangerous, and disruptive, not just for Europe and creating a humanitarian crisis there, but also for globally. And I think that's probably what's really significant here as well. You know, I've worked in Iraq on that crisis for several years, was in Baghdad, had an impact on the world in terms of oil prices and other things. But the impact of this particular one is much more devastating, not just for the developed nations in Europe, but for the whole world, particularly the ones that I'm working on now, which is those in the developing world where people are much more vulnerable to shocks.
We're going to come back to some of you know, the ripple effects. But I wonder if you could also, you know, you mentioned that the conflict itself is discouraging, and that was a theme that was shared by several world leaders on the 24th as they were marking the six-month anniversary of Russia's renewed aggression on Ukraine. You know, where do you see the greatest challenges as this conflict continues to go on? Because several analysts, several politicians say that there's really no early end in sight.
As we approach winter in particular, the challenges as it relates to heating and the preparation for Ukraine for the winter means that there's going to be a lot of suffering this winter. And it's going to be a very difficult year ahead. So I don't think we should kid ourselves that because there may be a stalemate at the front in terms of where lines are moving, that in any way Ukraine can return or Europe to normalcy, or Russia for that matter. This conflict is going to continue to play out in a way that's really devastating for lots of people. I think what you're going to see likely, though, is that Russia is working on strengthening its land corridor to Crimea from the rest of Russia through Ukraine, and its desire to have its strategic capability to control the flow in and out of the Black Sea. I don't think they'll be satisfied to stop there in the long term. They may be satisfied to stop at that point for a while, but I think the long-term desire of Putin and Russia is to see Ukraine integrated into the broader Russian space. That's obviously something Ukrainians are not going to put up with. But I think we're going to see this play out really over years.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, you know, was marking the anniversary, and he said that NATO supports Ukraine, that it has essentially its back. It's going to support it as long as it takes. But he also noted that most likely this conflict is going to end at the negotiating table. However, Moscow and Kyiv are not talking. What do you see in your experience in diplomacy as a diplomat, as former ambassadors to Belarus, to Greece? What needs to happen in order to have the conversation to end the conflict, given that President Zelensky has said that, you know, the war essentially started with Russia annexing Crimea, it's going to end with Ukraine retaking that territory, and that Ukraine as a whole is not going to cede any territory that's currently under Russian occupation?
I think what people will be looking for is not an end in the sense of a permanent end, because I don't think that is in sight in the context of how you can see this playing out, that Ukrainians, after this much devastation, aren't going to be willing to kind of just accede to the Russians having taken over that territory. At the same time, the punishing effect of a war over time does have a big impact on people, on a population. And I think what the diplomats will probably be looking for, is there a way to stop the violence and put a halt, at least, to the humanitarian crisis that is resulting as a result of that on so many lives? And if you can get to a place where it's at least a holding pattern where there is a region disputed by the Russians and the Ukrainians, and you can try to move that into other channels, the diplomatic channels that in the minds of many would be a positive move just in terms of saving lives and saving humanitarian catastrophes. At the same time, I don't think we're anywhere close yet, right? This is for Ukraine about their freedom, about their country, about their territorial integrity, about having an invasion, about having displaced literally a quarter of their country with 7 or 8 million people inside their country having to flee their homes, another 7 or so million people having left the country. There is an animosity there towards the Russian violence that is not going to settle down quickly. And the dynamic gets very tricky for political leaders because you have to be very careful if you look like you're the one that's agreeing to the Russian occupation. So it's not going to be an easy walk for President Zelensky to figure out how to put a pause on the fighting. And same thing for President Putin, right? He's whipped up a lot of sentiment, and you've seen some of that recently in the recent bombing that happened in Russia. There's a lot of anger and animosity there as well. So I don't foresee that happening quickly. At the same time, as a diplomat, you have to hope for an end to violence because the violence never really begets anything positive.
So in terms of security in Europe, I wanted to pick your brain on this because you yourself just moments ago mentioned that perhaps Putin would not necessarily be content with just moving into Ukraine. That's a thought that's been echoed by several other leaders in Europe. We've seen Finland and Sweden move away from their long-held neutral status to joining NATO, and some have even said that perhaps NATO needs to expand further. So in terms of security concerns for Europe, what do you see as the greatest challenges moving forward, given that this conflict is likely to last a significant amount of time?
I'm less worried that the Russians will threaten, say, Poland or Hungary or Czech Republic or others, and more concerned about how the dynamic is going to play out by creating the frozen conflict in Ukraine that then creates a split inside the European countries as to who wants to be more flexible at the negotiating table and who wants to be more hardline in terms of setting the principles that this is not acceptable that in a modern Europe that you can have a conventional war where Russia moves into another country and occupies territories. So I think that's going to create over time some tensions in the European security infrastructure. So far, it actually has worked to promote greater strength of NATO unity and a stronger sense of solidarity among the European countries. What will be interesting to see is as Putin squeezes through the gas supplies this winter and countries have to take steps to reduce their use of gas during what could be a cold winter, potentially affecting also their industries, whether the political support that the governments need in these countries will maintain itself. There's a big asymmetry here, right? If you're Russia, you don't need political support from the general population, right? Putin doesn't have to worry about the next election, whereas in Western European countries, you do. So watching how that plays out will be something interesting. I do think, though, that this is such an important issue in terms of European security and the idea of avoiding any sense of appeasement, given the dynamic that led to World War II, that you will see NATO holding over time fairly firm, as well as the United States, and continue to support Ukraine militarily. And that's actually, at the end of the day, the key to Ukraine's ability to continue to fight off Russian advances.
I want to follow up on the gas issue that you just mentioned, because that's one of the humanitarian concerns that many people have. Winter is coming, to borrow a line from Game of Thrones. But with Russia supplying historically so much natural gas and other hydrocarbons to Europe, and Europe now working to wean itself off of that as much as possible, to bring up some stores, to have a stockpile ready for what some are saying may be a cold winter. What challenges does it perhaps give, because some countries are in better shape in terms of being able to supply their own constituency with gas for heating. There are other areas that don't have that kind of capability. And with winter, you may not be able to adequately provide for your people given the cold weather. So what do you see as the greatest challenges in trying to navigate that with Russia continuing its aggression toward Ukraine?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. We still have to watch how this plays out. Both Germany still getting roughly 35% of its gas from Russia, and France about 17%. Those are really big numbers, right? I do expect that those countries will have plans in place to manage it so that the cost to the civilian populations in those countries will be the least significant. It'll probably be industry that will suffer in some ways more to make sure that people have heating for their home and so forth. But it's going to have a significant impact on economies, as well as potential for some rolling shutdowns in the gas to home heating as well. What will be interesting to watch is what's happening in Ukraine, right? If the Russians are smart, they will back off on the fighting. They will try to move to the negotiating table. They will avoid bad headlines of civilians getting bombed and rockets hitting schools and hospitals. But there's still going to be a lot of pictures of Ukrainians essentially shivering in what is no heating in uninsulated places as all these displaced people try to survive the winter. And I think in some ways, if those photos keep emerging, and that's the situation for the Ukrainians, and the Ukrainians are willing to continue to fight for their independence and their freedom, I think you're going to see that on the European countries as well, that the populace are going to be sympathetic to the Ukrainians' plight and will be willing in the short run for one winter to put up with this. In the longer run, they won't be, because over time people get worn out of this type of thing, particularly in democracies. But there will be, I think we talked about that earlier, what the strategic impacts of this. Mm-hmm. There is going to be a long-term strategic shift away from Russia. And it can't underestimate how significant this is going to be on the Europe-Russia relationship over the long term, because you can bet that Germany, which just recently, a few years ago, was all for these pipelines supplying more gas to Germany in the face of what was at the time U.S. opposition to that kind of dependence, that feeling has changed completely in Germany. And so that's going to mean a lot less dependence on Russian energy over the years. That means a lot less money for Russia. That means a long-term impact on the Russian economy and a weakening of the interdependence of Russia and Europe, which isn't good for Russia.
Ambassador Daniel Speckert is the president of the NGO Chorus International. And we'll pick up the rest of our conversation on Friday's program to get the ambassador's thoughts on the humanitarian impact on the world as the war continues. And finally, this fact check from Polygraph.info.
On August 4th, a Russian court sentenced U.S. basketball star Brittany Griner to 9 years behind bars after hash oil was found in her luggage. News reports say the United States could hand over Russian arms trafficker Viktor Bout in exchange for Griner. With a potential prisoner swap in the spotlight, a Russian diplomat brought up the case of a different Russian once in U.S. jails. Just remember Maria Butina. She was unfairly held in prison for over 18 months, abused, harassed, and tortured. That is false. Butina was a Russian agent. In December 2018, she pleaded guilty to conspiracy and acting under the direction of the Russian government. Prosecutors said Butina infiltrated conservative circles to establish a secret channel for Russia to, quote, penetrate the U.S. national decision-making apparatus. Butina's handler, Alexander Torshin, has been linked to Russian President Vladimir Putin and Russian mafia activity. Butina spent 15 months in prison and denied that she was abused. But after deportation to Russia, she flip-flopped, calling her time in solitary confinement torture. Butina later got a job at Russia's state broadcaster RT and a seat in parliament. She has been sanctioned by the United States as a, quote, key enabler of Moscow's war on Ukraine.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with the latest developments not only in Ukraine, but around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.